And welcome to New Books in South Asian Studies, hosted by Thara Anjaria out of Bombay, India. We are in for a double treat today. Nabil Matar and Gerald MacLean will both be talking to us about their fantastic collaborative effort, Britain and the Islamic World. Gerald is a professor of English at Exeter University and Nabil at Minnesota. And they put together a wonderful book, redolent of the smells of the bazaar and the sea, of ports and souks from London to Tangier to Constantinople to Delhi. They are going to talk to us about how trade flooded markets across Britain, the Levant, the Persian world and South Asia with exotic products, disdained and desired by the locals in equal measure. Of course, it wasn't all coffee and silks. There were pirates, captives, and long stretches of anxious waiting in the courts of foreign potentates, never knowing when you might be seized and thrown into a bear pit or equivalent. People wrote about these too. Not that it deterred the many who set out from their native lands hoping to feather their nests, as William Hawkins put it in 1609. So let's join Nabil and Gerald as they talk us through these fascinating lives. Good morning, Professor MacLean.
Good morning. Good morning. I hope that the weather there is nicer than here.
No, it's fine. Thanks for doing this for the New Books Network. Mm-hmm. And it's a pleasure to have you talk to us.
Thank you.
And I can see that you've had a long career. Could you just tell us something about your academic work to date?
My academic work to date. About 20 years ago, I shifted. I had started out as a specialist in English 17th century poetry and English 17th century, mostly radical writing, the way that print culture had impacted upon the political and social and cultural revolutions of the 17th century. I specialized in poetry because there was a good deal of poetry written at the time that was engaged politically in ways that were not being recognized at the time. This is probably before many of your listeners were born. This is in the late 70s, early 80s. During that period, I came to work on a project to do with the return of monarchy and the end of revolution in England, because it struck me that 1660, when the revolution failed and monarchy returned to England, was in many respects like what happened after 1968, the social revolution that I was optimistic of at the time, and that there was a great upsurge of a certain kind of culture that overwhelmed politics, if we can put it so crudely. At the time, the joke among myself and among my radical friends was, we wanted a revolution and we got the Beatles. Yeah. And so I noticed that in 1660, a good deal of energy was put into writing poetry about how wonderful a return to monarchy would be. And it became clear to me that there was so much of this that clearly a lot of people needed to be persuaded that this was a good thing. So I set about a project of working on how poetry was about legitimation of the political regime. And during the work on that, I will get to the point, this is now about 1990-1991, I discovered that a great deal of the material made allusion to the Ottoman Empire. And as a young person, I had traveled in Turkey and discovered that Turkey isn't the horrible place that many people think it is, that the Turks are actually very nice people. They're not the horrible people of stereotype coming from the Crusades right up to Angela Merkel and the rest of it. And this struck a chord, so I started working on how the English had understood, thought about the Ottomans in the period after 1660. Poets would assume that people reading those poems would know who the Turks were, and many of the allusions were very obscure. It was assumed even by popular balladeers that their readers would know that in 1622, Sultan Osman had been executed by the Janissaries, that there had been these parallels between events in the Ottoman Empire and England during its revolutionary period. So I began working on this material, and this led me to think I would write a book about English attitudes towards the Ottomans. After about 300 pages of the first draft, I was getting nowhere. I was still writing about Tamburlaine back in the late 16th century, so I gave up and said, right, return to Edward Said, and noticed he makes a very clear distinction over the question of citationality and the way that certain kinds of discourse generate themselves out of their own discourse, as opposed to what we might call empirical or other kinds of evidence. So I thought the trick then is to write a book about the travelers, those who first actually encountered the Ottoman Empire. But some of them had been looked at before, but there'd been no systematic study of English visitors into the various regions of the Ottoman Empire in the early period, which is the period that the English were opening up trading agreements. Elizabeth had been excommunicated and so was looking to engage in trade with non-Catholic countries such as the Ottomans, the Moroccans, and there was a good deal of commercial activity. So I worked on that for a number of years, traveled to all of the countries that I thought were directly relevant, retraced the routes of the four selected travelers I decided to use as typical, and then brought out another book on studies of the same question of how the English represented and understood the Ottomans, but using some of the material that was citational, that was running itself from its own discourses. It wasn't based on empirical first-hand evidence. It was a little bit more theoretical, but I've tried to keep this as accessible as possible, since, of course, the big story, if there is a big story, relations between the West and the Islamic East at that time were not uniformly hostile, certainly in the period. And this is a gap in Said, if you will, a gap in Orientalism, it really begins with the 18th century, the moment of Western hegemony starting up. In the centuries before this, the relations were entirely different. The Ottomans were the powerful ones looking over at the Austro-Hungarians and the Spanish. The Spanish were powerful too, of course, I'm not diminishing that, but the Ottomans were in power. So this is quite a different dynamic from anything that later centuries do. And I thought that was very interesting to examine. But as I say, I wanted to get the message out that there had been close affinities, alliances, agreements, encounters between East and West, not uniform hostility. Certainly through the 16th and 17th century, more Christians are killing other Christians, Catholics are killing Protestants, and in the Islamic world, Sunni are killing Shia. The wars between the Safavids and the Ottomans, the death toll is greater, Turks killing Muslims, killing Muslims, Christians killing than Christians killing Muslims. So those kinds of facts, it seems to me, are very important to sort of try and get out and keep out. And so I've tried to sort of, you know, be writing, as it were, for a larger market. Clearly, doing this work, I spent a lot of time in Turkey. I've not become too involved in internal Turkish politics. It's not up to me to do this, but I've watched what's been going on for the last 20 years. So in fact, at the moment, I'm writing after the Britain, the Islamic World that I co-authored with Nabil Mahtar that I think we're here to talk about today. I've already started on a biography of the current president of Turkey, Abdullah Gül. So I sort of shifted for the moment into not exactly contemporary, but to the 20th century and early 21st century. This will be a social history of Turkey, a social political history of Turkey during his lifetime. So it's a political historical biography of what's been going on in Turkey since World War II. Where next, after the book with Nabil, I have two things in mind. One would be, again, a biography of one of the early English ambassadors to the Ottoman Empire, a chap called Thomas Glover, who led an adventurous, exciting, and in many ways unusual life. So this might be the kind of trade book that would reach a very popular audience if I could write it properly. The other would be to pick up the question of travelers and to work on 18th century and early 19th century English travelers. The way the view changed, the personal encounter, the face-to-face encounter during the rise of the British Empire, which hasn't fully been worked through yet. And there again, some of the work in the 16th and 17th century might be informative. So there's a quick answer to your first question.
Would you say that your work occupies the space between literature and travel writing and historiography? I mean, what do you think of, you know, the link, the connections between maybe travel writing and what we now see as the colonial project?
Yes. But travel writing came in as a side issue to me. I was certainly interested in various kinds of colonial writing, post-colonial writing, but as it were on the side. I think of myself as a 17th century cultural historian of Englishness, if we can put it that way. So travel is certainly important, and I think what Nabila and I have tried to suggest here is that the ambitions, the colonial, that there's an imperial ambition, which is slightly different from a colonial one, operating in what we might call the English. And by that, I don't mean English people, I mean the English language. This is going on in US writing as well. So in the Anglophone world, it seems to me that in the 16th, 17th century, there's a specific kind of imperial ambition bound up with maritime supremacy. And one of the things we try to track quietly in Britain and the Islamic world is the way this very quickly started transforming itself into various outposts, and thus colonial ambition in the East. But the mirror between what the Brits, the English were doing in the New World, in the Americas, is really in many ways a different story, because they're dealing with what they thought of as relatively open, available worlds of primitive, savage people that could be controlled by the use of steel and so on, which has never been quite the same profile as we go east. So I think the ambitions for colonies and colonializing take two different sort of directions. People have worked on this. It's not something I'm a specialist on. I've not worked on people like Thomas Smith, who were members of the Levant Company, who then joined the Virginia Company, and were thinking through the different ways of expropriating natural resources from people, which is obviously different if you're dealing with indigenous people, such as the folks in the Americas, who are living very close to the land, and then highly developed civilizations, but quite different from what we can recognize, even in North Africa and further east. So, yes, it's bound up with this, but travel as such hasn't actually been a prime focus. And that would be, it was in that book, but the question I was asking is, how is it that travelers encountering this Islamic other find themselves relating to a more powerful world of people who, which is quite contrary to what Said expects us to find in the Orientalist paradigm. So travel was important, but I've done a bit of work since in travel writing. But I still think of myself as trying to map the trajectory of notions of English national identity as it encounters the world. And yes, indeed, that becomes part of the ambitions, it seems to me, for a kind of empire that is not initially about colonizing. It's about maritime possibility. Although having said that, one of the earliest ambitions that Elizabeth had, so we're talking 1580s, 1590s, and we talk about this in the book, is a scheme between Muley Ahmed in Morocco and Elizabeth to join together and to oust the Spanish from Central America. And British ships will transport Moroccans and various people the Moroccans will put together to colonize certain areas in the Caribbean. This never came about, but this was among the plans. So the question of specific colonization as opposed to empire building was indeed on the agenda. But I think, as I say, there are two specific sort of networks here to do with the old and the new that I haven't anything original or startling to say about.
So the book, could you just tell us something about the book, the book in a nutshell?
Yes. At the time I was finishing my second book, Looking East, which are the studies of various writings about the Ottomans. Nabil and I had known each other in various ways. We'd met at conferences. We'd exchanged research with each other. And we were actually at a conference together in London in 2001. And it occurred to me as we were chatting that what there wasn't was a good general overview of this early period when, indeed, the Orientalist paradigm didn't work and that perhaps this could be written up into, indeed, a general book that would appeal. And that the two of us together could cover very nicely
with our expertise, various, what we could call the Islamic Mediterranean. And we projected a book together that would be about England entering the Mediterranean, which is an extraordinary thing to happen. After centuries, if you talk to Mediterranean historians, they say, why suddenly in the 16th century the Brits arrived? Every other nation that's relevant has already passed through the Mediterranean. So our initial focus was towards Mediterranean studies and Britain's arrival in the Islamic Mediterranean up to the point of the British Empire. And we floated that with a couple of trade publishers. And eventually, working with editors and so on, we ended up with OUP. Big trade publishers didn't want it. They want global history, and we were doing just a bit of it. And OUP, I think the conversation there rightly suggested that we should at least take on the Mughal and Safavid empires and look a bit further east, because the English were starting to move further east and track what was going there. And in doing that, I hope it's clear to readers of the book that we're not trying to write social, cultural, political histories of the Ottomans, the Safavids, and the Mughals, where all the varieties of Islam being practiced in those countries among those peoples. We are, again, very specifically talking about what the English, British thought, imagined, knew, could understand. So that there's that focus. We're not trying to say anything specifically about the varieties of religious faith and culture and society in the Islamic world as such. But in taking on just even a brief glance, Nabil knows very well the North African material. He spent years in the Moroccan archives. I have many friends who work in the Ottoman archives. I'm not a Turkologist, but I have a good control. So we put those two together and then added on the Safavid Mughal encounters. And in doing so, you know, came up with a number of interesting ideas that we've tried to explore. One being that, of course, something we hadn't really thought about and hasn't been addressed is that the English meeting other Christians, Christians of the Eastern faiths, was happening in Islamic spaces. And it was happening all the way, shall we say, from Istanbul, Aleppo, all the way across to Eastern India. I mean, there were these other kinds, these weird Christians that had been in diaspora for a long time. So that seemed a new track that was worth exploring for a bit. There's also the question of this, what I've already characterized as the sort of, you know, development of the imperial into the colonial, perhaps. A pure maritime bred imperialism does, of course, open up in the Indian Ocean as English shipping beats out the Portuguese and takes over, and the East India Company gets its money and its wealth and power from simply shipping across the Indian Ocean. It's not doing much more than that after a while, or that's where much of its wealth is coming from. So there's that simply maritime-based making money that we can attach to a certain kind of imperial ambition. But it's once the Brits start getting the thought of, you know, having to protect their shipping, that we get the garrisons and so on that would be impossible in North Africa until later in the 17th century, when Tangiers is taken over disastrously for a while. So those developments seem very interesting, because the attitude, again, within the Orientalist, the Saidian Orientalist frame, of attitudes towards the weaker or the more powerful are here at issue. And that there are, beyond that very simple binary, there are gradations, because obviously the North African Barbary groups, the Deys and Beys, nominally under Ottoman, are operating quite differently from the Ottomans. They're operating quite differently from the various outposts in Aleppo. And by the time the Brits are dealing with folks hardly at all among the Safavids, but there's still negotiation going on, and that is one of very much subordination. That there they know they're dealing with a more powerful people. And the same is true when we arrive in the subcontinent, when the English arrive in the subcontinent. This is obviously a much more powerful civilization than anything going on in England, where people are still eating, you know, out of wooden bowls with wooden spoons and the rest of it. And it's interesting that there is and that's the site where the thought of planting colonies in the East becomes, on one hand, I suppose, a necessity because of the distance, and on the other hand, a real possibility because probably because of the maritime might in the Indian Ocean. So this question of the relation between the various regions that major trade was going on is, again, one we develop in the book, that on the one hand, most people in England would probably think of Muslims of Islam in terms of the still horrendous figure of the Turk, who is the pirate, who is the corsair coming out of North Africa. More educated people would have some understanding of the Ottomans, little knowledge available about the Safavids, but some, couple of plays, and very little knowledge about the Mughals. So as ignorance at home gets wider, various things are going on that have to do with, I think, the development, both of British national ambition, imperial ambition, colonial ambition. Now, the trick to the colonialization project is, I think, apart from at the theoretical level and the evidence we have, and there's a lot of that, one of the things that Nabil, in fact, a point he's made quite strongly, is that during that period, that's the same period, late 16th, early 17th century, the enormous number of records that were pouring in from the Levant Company and indeed the East India Company, and as these companies take over, the correspondence and records that they've kept still haven't been examined. And they do tell quite a different, often in minor ways, different story from what you get in the captivity narratives, even from what you get in the traveler's report. And that work, there are five PhDs need to work through that. I mean, the records are just too extensive to make generalizations, other than we would have a slightly different understanding if what the agents in those countries were writing home to England had been the popular public report. I hope I'm making sense.
Yeah, it's very interesting because, you know, you have all these really diverse accounts and then, you know, people in different parts of the Islamic world, and obviously they're in different situations, you know, in different positions of power. So, I mean, they all have very different accounts to tell. So, do you think that, like, maybe after the period of the book, you know, when, let's say, Europeans or the English became more dominant, this kind of diversity in the travel accounts is lost, you know, it becomes more uniform?
I suspect so. I mean, this would be one thing I'd wish to examine if that becomes the next project, that by the 18th century, certainly one thing that 18th century travellers, I've tried to stay away from Lady Mary Wortley Montagu because she's so overwritten about. I mean, not overwritten about, she's a fascinating figure. But to try and say anything original, I think is difficult. I did give a paper on her some years ago in which I made the very simple point that by the time she goes, she is very, very much caught up in this Saidian citational system of correcting, engaging with prior accounts. And I think that's a key feature of what happens as we leave the 17th century. The Ottomans have proceeded as a military force in Europe after Karlowitz in the 1680s, 1690s. And a lot is known because there's been all of the materials that I've been working on for the last 20 years have been circulating and are in print. So certainly for a traveller like Lady Mary, an educated aristocrat, if you will, knowledge about where she's going is there before you go, which is quite different. Now, that isn't to say that leads to or encourages imperial ambition, but it just changes the perspective of the traveller. If the traveller is travelling as she did she had particular reasons, her husband was going, but she travels as a cultural tourist rather than as a diplomat or as a merchant. And I think there's an increasing amount of that, of a certain kind of cultural tourism, often bound up with trade. But people did genuinely travel out for scientific reasons in the 18th century. They're going out to examine flora, fauna, keep records of marvels of nature that can be found in these countries. Mineralogy is a big issue. The Russells in Aleppo were resident traders, but they were also early scientists. So the Royal Society was encouraging travel. So the travelers had various different reasons for going. In terms of the commercial trading interests, the issues dealing with North Africa and the Spanish kept one set of foreign policy and trade and foreign policy engaged with those kinds of things. But the growth of the EIC, of the East India Company, I think is a story better known by others than me. And I think that in some ways that's a slightly different story from the story of the travelers who started traveling east out of the Ottoman regions. increasingly, there are some fascinating accounts by members of the East India Company looking to find an overland route to India. So instead of going all the way around by sea, mid-18th century, there again are some fascinating accounts. So these are commercial chaps, but they have their own pretensions to philosophical knowledge or cultural knowledge. So those accounts need writing. I have a PhD student working on it at the moment, so I won't say much more. We'll see what he comes up with. But those have been little examined and I think showed interesting light on the way traveling across the desert with a particular imperial ambition, of course, which is why they're traveling. These guys look at the landscape, look at the social organization. One of them is very good, or an argument that Mohammed, my student, is working on, is the discovery that the desert isn't a desert space. It's a place where trade is going on. How can we exploit it? There may be, you can look for 360 degrees and see no one, but the next day you'll meet a camel train and some kind of exchange is happening. The oases are places where trade, how can we exploit it? So on the one hand, there is that tendency to think in explicitly exploited terms. So the Orientalist, as Saeed would have it, mindset is very much kicking in during the 18th century, I think. But partly that's because prior knowledge, growth of power, growth of what the Elizabethans we could call an ambition, an imperial ambition or a fantasy of Britain taking on the Spanish, is now very much the struggle in the Atlantic against the Spanish and in the Mediterranean. And the English are winning it. I mean, they're holding up. They're doing well. So, yes, they're starting to flex their muscles in the East also. And the EIC trade is going more and more powerful. And at a certain level, the use of British force in the rural areas has proved successful and largely uncontested. They've beaten up the Portuguese and everyone's been, of course not, but, you know, locals were not displeased to work with the English and the British instead of the Portuguese. So I think, yes, there's a calculation there. I think these are not nice people, you know, mm-hmm. In terms of greed ambition.
You mentioned this thing that the locals were not displeased, you know, to work for the Portuguese, for the English. And again, that's very much in stark contrast to later accounts where it's made out that they didn't really like this. So well, do you have any local... Yeah.
I'm thinking of just the way certain, what I understand, certain, you know, traders in certain Gujarati ports were happier to deal with the English than the Portuguese. And this is the sort of thing the English report about themselves. I'm trying to think back. Look, I mean, some of the viziers preferred the Portuguese to the English. Mukarrab Khan, I think, was a great hater of the English early on and could perhaps see that something nasty was going on there. I'm just thinking in the very, very general terms of the English presence. You're thinking of specific pro, if only we hadn't got the, you see, it's a period where I'm slightly unlearning. Are there reports of why we wish the Portuguese would come back?
I don't know. But that is something that I'm interested in, you know, my current work. It just looks at a comparative assessment of colonialisms across Southeast Asia, you know, like what the English, for example, thought of other colonial powers. So also I'm looking at local reactions to different European powers. So do we have any other, like, reactions apart from the English? What did maybe the Portuguese think of the Muslims? What did the French think, you know, when they traveled? Do we have any account?
Well, we do. I mean, the big difference, I think, and it's one of the elements of early British imperialism that I think the Brits learned from the Ottomans, as opposed to the Spanish or the Portuguese, is don't try and convert the locals. Mm-hmm. So the Portuguese had missions, I believe, to convert people to Catholicism. The French were always trying to convert people.
Yeah.
The Spanish are always trying to convert people. And one of the things that the Protestant British tradespeople figured out early on was don't do that. Much of one of the things they'd learned in their examining of the success of the Ottoman Empire was that you don't do that. Look at what's going on in the New World. They're slaughtering local people. They're devastating their own labor force. What's going on? I mean, these kinds of recognition, I think, were very much part of the way, I think, the British imperial imagination develops in tune with its understanding of the Ottomans. And so the Brits in Southeast Asia never attempted conversion. So again, in terms of local responses, I couldn't say because this is not my field, but I would imagine that while obviously some people happily converted to Catholicism, there are a lot of people who would be offended by Portuguese attempts to convert them, which the Brits never did. And certainly for the Brits themselves, that was one of the points of pride, that we're doing something better, which of course is going to become the full-blown, we're improving these people. It's become that horrible moral mission of the British Empire that fortunately hasn't yet. I haven't encountered it yet. My writers don't get there yet. I think that's 18th century. Maybe my historiography is wrong. So I think the British presence in Southeast Asia was distinct from, and I would hope, can importantly be distinguished over that business of not seeking to convert the locals.
The English themselves, they were definitely worried, you know, about a lot of maybe the traders, the English diaspora converting to Islam, maybe adopting Islamic cultural practices, which you mentioned a lot, you know, in the book. And yeah. I find that very interesting.
Yeah. Yes, again, that's coming up. It's something that William Dalrymple obviously has treated brilliantly in White Mughals. This fear suddenly that the new, you know, in some ways, this is the story of the East India Company and the people running it and their own fears, anxieties, and world conditions. The Brits are becoming more and more powerful. Napoleon's, you know, about to get defeated or is, you know, on the run as we go into the 19th century. And I think there is a move, which again, Dalrymple has traced very, very nicely, that often this comes about through a particular moment in the history of the East India Company, when the mentality of the company itself takes over. And that's again specific to the East India Company, and its success and its power. But, such things were never there in earlier periods. So I'm stalling a little bit in terms of your question, which is about local responses to the British presence still. But certainly the Brits are not the benign presence they would like to think of themselves as. It is interesting. It has started. I think we tracked the first use of military force by a British armed unit in a foreign, that is to say, Islamic country, takes place in the 1660s, 1670s. It's a failure, but there is a military attempt. And certainly there's that militarizing of our own, the Brits militarizing of their own trading posts is new and indicative of a certain kind of distance from and mutual fear of. We don't find, well, it couldn't happen elsewhere. It couldn't happen in North Africa. Until Tangiers, and Tangiers is such a disaster.
But you know, the stay-at-home English, and you know, they had all these traders coming back, and they had all these products coming in, and you know, as you've seen, their reaction was very different. They liked the things, you know, but they didn't always appreciate the cultural baggage that their own diaspora brought back.
That's right. I think you've suggested one thing in your question, which is we've really got three different kinds of Brits. Or we've got those who stay and consume, those who go and grow rich and stay and convert, and those who go get rich but come home. And I think that's still very much we could find those structures within British society today. God save us! I mean, there are any number of folks living today who are living off of the accumulated wealth of a nation they've never visited. So, I mean, yes, I think we're talking about the large-scale change to what it meant to be English. If you were, again, I always go back to the beginning of the 16th century when people were insular. They were insignificant. They were ignored. They weren't part of the world system. The French knew about them.
Yeah.
But, you know, basically, they were an insignificant little island race. They were the Lilliputians in Swift. They were this, like, insignificant, horrid little backbiting, but that whatever that tells us, the people then were local, they were regional, they were insular. The entire movement of the 16th century, as shipping, as British shipping became more and more powerful and trade became more important and people started going, is you get a fragmentation of what it meant, means to be English and new kinds of fragmentation within the social open up. I'm not saying that it wasn't fragmented before, but new kinds of fragmentation open up as you gave us those who stay at home and consume but dislike.
You were talking about material. Yeah, just continue.
Yeah. Well, I think the material culture question, again, is something that probably needs a couple of young, enthusiastic people with their careers ahead of them to crack the whole range and fabric of. There's a marvelous moment in Pepys when, as customs officer, he goes aboard an English ship that's just come back from Malagasy, I think. And he says the entire hold was filled with black peppercorns. And he'd never seen so much wealth in his life. Black pepper as a drug was one of the most valuable commodities. And it must have been like those Portuguese seeing the first galleon come back that had so much gold on it, they couldn't imagine what to do, so they built Lisbon. There are these kinds of moments in terms of material culture that are very difficult to play out. The sudden sort of burst of excess that I think is going on in the larger period. In England, as for the book, we focused on those elements of material culture that we thought we could tell a story about in terms of the differences and kinds of differences that went on. Certainly, importations of drugs, spices has been going on for a while. Elizabeth could afford to have sugar. Most people couldn't. Sugar was coming from North Africa. What the increased expansion begins with, primarily, I think, in terms of volume and value, is silk. And it's that opening up of silk is something that people want, that becomes very central to the whole exchange mechanism of flow into and out of the Mediterranean. The English are buying their silks largely through Venetian merchants. They can cut out the Venetians by going directly to the Ottomans. Their deals with the Ottomans lead within 30 years to an enormous silk industry that's employing thousands of people. They're importing raw silk by the 1600s, 1610s, and machining it in factories around London, employing thousands of people. So in terms of the kinds of impact that one commodity had, it's not simply that more and more wealthy urban women could put a bit of silk in their clothes. They're not wearing silk dresses yet, so lower middle class, the middling sort, they're slashing their dresses with silk. And it's still a very expensive commodity, but it's becoming part of the industrialization of the British economy too, because such is the trade that they open up their own silk merchants, silk manufacturing plants, and are producing finished silk that then gets exported to countries like Poland and to Russia, to places that don't have. It's going back in many respects. So at that level, the question of material culture becomes very problematic. It is not simply a question of the consumer. It's a question also of the producer, and in this case, women working in the factories doing the spinning. And it becomes a major problem by the early 18th century, as we tell. Cotton has come in because cheap Indian cotton has come, and it becomes the Manchester cotton industry. So on the one hand, there is the big story of the consumption of tea, of sugar, of coffee, of silk, which are entering in and filtering through the social strata. The opening of the coffee houses is obviously a big, important Islamic influence. And there are so many of these different aspects that we partly told the textile story, because I think textiles is the biggie. But there are other edges to it. One I've worked on my own, perhaps more than in the book together, is the business of aristocratic portrait collections that, again, tied to the imperial desire, as certain Brits, certain English people are starting to think about themselves internationally. But looking at images of power, having collections, we're talking here about aristocratic collections in which, say, a dozen portraits of great emperors from throughout history would be commissioned and hanged in the estate. We have inventories that show that most of the larger aristocracy had their own personal collections in their country houses or their estates, and that many, you know, middling sorts, many newly wealthy, find themselves knighthoods, would aspire to the aristocratic status by also having commissioned collections of imperial portraits. And the Sultan invariably figures in these. The Turk is one of the great images of power on display. And so, the Eastern isn't always a bad thing in the early period, but the great Eastern potentate is a picture of power and to be admired and envied and studied. He's part of the system of the ambitious. So that's quite different from the shopkeeper's wife slashing and drinking tea.
So
once you put that against the Manchester cotton mills of the late 18th century, which is where the story we're getting to, the whole material culture world, that is indeed, again, a couple of PhDs that one day will have material.
Yeah, what I found the most interesting was the section about the horses. You know, like we talk about the influence on the English thoroughbred. There's one incident, I think, in the 1830s when the English, you know, they wanted to make advances to Ranjit Singh. And I think they specially built a boat and they shipped out four English Shire horses and they, you know, took them up the Indus to give them to Ranjit Singh, and he was fascinated, you know. So I just think it was a case of being fascinated by the kind of equine stock that the party had. I didn't realize that the English were also, you know, this much into horses. I mean, with foreign horses. But I do know that, I think, William Moorcroft, he was a servant of the company, and he was sent on a horse sourcing reconnaissance mission somewhere in Central Asia.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah.
Well, that's the story of equestrianism between Britain and the subcontinent goes right almost to the present day. I lose track. It's certainly a vigorous story of exchange, admiration, learning from each other. In terms of tack, I know that there's still a lot of horse tack goes on. There is a shared equestrian interest. The English equestrian story is really my partner, Donald Andrews' story, cited in the footnotes. Perhaps you ought to interview her at some point, who's written.
Yeah, we should be.
Well, I can call her to come to talk to you after we're done. The discovery that Donna's broadcast in her book Noble Brutes is that this still current English belief that the English thoroughbred is a symbol, an icon of Englishness, right? So again, we're talking about these imaginations of the self as a member of a nation and so on. As an icon, the thoroughbred is a very powerful across the classes. People may hate hunting, but they still recognize Whistlejacket, the great painting, as part of what Englishness. And part of that story is that there were four that's been put about because of the thoroughbred regulations in this country to do with racing and the rest of it, that every pure thoroughbred must be tracked back through the registers to one of four Arab stallions that was brought into England at a certain time. And that story is pervasive, and it's factually important because you can't register your horse as a thoroughbred unless you can trace its bloodstock back to one of those four. So it's a powerful story, but it is a false one insofar as Donna has shown, throughout the late 16th and through the 17th and well into the 18th century, vast numbers of horses were coming in from North Africa. North African horses were coming in from Spain. Many stallions were coming in from the Ottoman Empire, which was illegal, but the consuls and ambassadors had set up, you know, a quiet business in importing great, famous Arab stallions out of, largely out of the Syrian areas. So they're coming out of Aleppo. And some of these horses were coming into England from Anatolia, so they've got Akhaltekhi coming from the Circassian areas. So there was a lot of mixing of new breeds and strange breeds and unrecognized breeds that went into the eventual production of what we now know as the thoroughbred, which is this great icon of Englishness. So that in brief is the story of that book. And I think it's a fascinating and important one that parallels nicely the sense that drinking tea is an English custom.
you know, what are these icons of Englishness? But they give us nice, thank you for bringing up the horses, they give us these nice endnotes to the question of how the English have defined themselves by, first of all, importing, then you transform it somehow and you reproduce it, you put milk in it, or you breed it with, as you say, a shy horse to give it a bit of substance. The thoroughbred was bred in England. This is the case, but it was bred out of more sources than is recognized, and has a lot to do with probably the importation of Arab and Bab and Anatolian mares as much as the great stallions. We track the lines through the stallions, but the large number of mares that was also coming in had a lot to do with it. So yes, and certainly the question of exchanges, of diplomatic and legal exchanges, where you would think records would have been kept, but that we know of a number of horses, Arabs coming into England that we don't have records for. I didn't know about the shires going the other way. They must have seemed enormous. They must have seemed like small elephants, a great big shire horse suddenly arriving. Although I imagine they'd have lost some weight on the ship.
I don't know. But going back to the book, what are your favorite travel accounts in the book? Which are the most outstanding ones?
Oh, what are my favorites? Oh, heavens,
yeah.
Heavens, too many. In BIW, I became fascinated with the embassy to Constantinople and Adana of John Finch, who was important for many reasons. He was sent out as ambassador in the 1670s, and he went out with his boyfriend, and there are a famous couple of the period. They had both been academics in Cambridge, and they had a marvelous time. They loved it. They travelled out to Adana, and so in terms of, you know, the pleasures of travel, he was caught up in a number of diplomatic disputes that he couldn't resolve. Fascinatingly, given the continuities of problems, the big one was, of course, the Ottomans controlled Jerusalem and had in their power the relative authorities of the Greek Orthodox and the Roman Catholic churches. And this was something that the English ambassadors to the Ottomans were always interested in interfering in, anything that could, you know, put down the Catholics particularly. They were less threatened by the Greek Orthodox. But Finch was engaged in trying to solve the problem, or at least to interfere in affairs in Jerusalem. So I think Finch, the story was told in the 20s. There's a book about him and his friend going out, Baines. Paul Baines died out, but Thomas Baines. They were both scholars. So I found, for this book, working through, I'd read most of these accounts in my travel book back in the early 90s. I systematically read, not every page by every diplomat, but I read through all of the published travel accounts, the manuscript travel accounts, and selected the four that I talked about that I used as examples in that book. So I was familiar with this stuff, but going back to it, found it much more interesting, and I read it in more detail. There are a number of, the rest of it for this book was how different the experiences were. So it wasn't really so much a question of particular travel accounts, I think, that struck me as fresh and new to this, but the diversity. Again, the question of how people English people who spent time and wrote about life in North Africa were really telling an entirely different story from those who spent time at the Ottoman or the Mughal court. I've always quite liked I'll probably have to default to the book I wrote about the travelers and say my favorite traveler, I think, is still probably Henry Blunt, whom I wrote about in 2004 in The Rise of Oriental Travel, who set out in the 1630s, having, as a precocious youngster, gone up to Oxford at 14, had just entered the Inns of Court, spent a couple of years at the Inns of Court when he was 18, 19, did a couple of missions that we don't know very much about, and then set off very much with self-declared new science mentality. He was, I've spoken of him as a Baconian, insofar as I think he was very much interested in the Baconian project of dismantling the idols of the tribe. He becomes a very religious person, but he's not an Orthodox Christian in any sense. But he's very interested in
again, Thomas Brown is doing it. What are the false beliefs that we have about the world? Is it the case that how could the Ottomans have become such a powerful organization if they were doing everything wrong? He wasn't buying into the religious argument that this was God punishing the Christians. Let's put it that way. But the usual answer, how can the Ottomans be so powerful? Well, it's God punishing us for being sinners. This was being preached constantly, right? And he said, no, this is all rubbish. So Blount set out to see for himself. And he actually avoided the places that most travelers went. And he made, according to his own account, conscious efforts to sort of blend in. He dressed locally. I don't know what languages he spoke, but he does seem to have generally got on with them. And he set out from Venice, he set out with a caravan of merchants from Venice, so he was mingling with a bunch of Jewish merchants going back, and they travelled in through what we would now call the Balkans. They landed at Split and travelled overland, so he went places other people didn't go, and spent his early period within Ottoman territory as a traveller, a passenger with a caravan. So, in fact, his mode of travel was very much that of a certain kind of, cultural tourist. And his ambition was to see how it actually worked on the ground, and I think that was valuable. He was almost entirely, as far as I can tell, non-judgmental. When they arrived and met up with an Ottoman army in Belgrade who was going against the Polish, he was invited in to meet the various pashas who were running it, and happily reported that the pashas going to the war, they take along their four best boyfriends for their pleasures, and they take along their six wives. These are the two top pashas. These kinds of stories, he's very happy with cultural difference. That a great general marching to war, has his boyfriends for pleasure and his wives to do the laundry and the cooking. Which would have been the sort of thing that other travellers at the time would have found unreportable. Or they might not have been the kind of people who would have even known that it was going on. They would have seen the display but not been able to talk to people well enough. So Blount, by the kinds of things he tells us, seems to have been, the ideal spy. I mean, I don't think he was spying. His book, when he came back, and it was published in 1636, which is of his travels with a good deal of analytical observations in it, does get advertised or celebrated in a poem as being the best guidebook to future traders and who are learning how to deal with foreign, more powerful, possibly hostile peoples. We get little tips like when you're traveling with a caravan, check out and find someone and give them a little money to tell you what's going on in case anyone's plotting against you. Have a colleague among the Janissary Guard when you're traveling with him. So he's full of little tips like this. But I think he was genuinely open in his attitude in ways all the other travelers were. Many of them were amazed and fascinated that they were still overcoming prejudices they hadn't prepared to think through. So I think Henry Blount is possibly my favorite. I would say that. The best story is always going to be that of the young apprentice who took an organ to the Sultan in 1599. The Rose story, which is for people in Asia, is probably the big story. There's so much of it. I mean, Roe has been broadcast, and he's very difficult to pin down. I think there is a very good biography of him, but he's very difficult to pin down. Richardson, at the same time that he was writing, I think, Pamela, not Clarissa, at the same time he was writing Pamela, was editing Roe's papers for publication. So he was very much part of the way the English literary mindset was forming itself. And that seems like a good, interesting moment that, Richardson is reading Roe even as he's writing about virtue and distress. I mean, it seems like a sort of Derridian, they'll never fit together. But in fact, they are utterly locked in certain ways, in the way British literature develops itself. And those kinds of questions about... I've lost the track now. I was bringing Roe. Oh, travellers.
Yeah.
Roe's accounts. I mean, Roe doesn't really write as a traveller and left a vast amount. And there have been a number of, I think, bad books about him, too. I think he's been misunderstood, partly because he was celebrated for so long as the father of British imperialism. So I think, in terms of favourites, I think if I had time and knowledge to learn enough about Southeast Asia in the time, Roe would be someone I would perhaps want to examine some more. Joseph Singh has done some very good work on him, but there are some eccentric things at the same time. So I think Roe's an interesting figure that hasn't yet, and Richmond Barber is very good on him. But someone needs to get the whole of Roe together at some point.
So you had all these people coming back to England and writing about their travels and publishing them, you know. So what was the official reaction to all these like books and memoirs? Was there any attempt to censor them or something?
Not that I've come upon. I think the market seems to have been an open one in which we think that there are a lot of them. Of course, a lot more people went who never came back. I've not come upon any censorship of travel accounts. No, I haven't. Thank you. That's something I should look for, inquire about. The only case of censorship that becomes an issue is the 1649 translation of the Quran.
Mm-hmm.
1649 is obviously a crucial year in all sorts of ways. There's a stable but insecure revolutionary government in charge and the rest of it, and they're about to execute the king, they've got him on trial. Their mind is exactly. The story of how the so-called English Quran of 1649 came about is still a disputed one. Nabil is certain that Alexander Ross did it. Alexander Ross penned the warning that appeared at the end of it saying, "Read this at your peril." But we don't actually know if he published it. We do know that the records allow us to know that its appearance became a problem in Parliament and that the printer and bookseller was hauled in before a parliamentary committee. The records of what went on in that committee aren't entirely clear. We don't have full reports. We know who's called in on a couple of occasions. Copies of the first printing were, it seems, seized but not destroyed. And within weeks, and again, this is just as the trial of the king is going on, he's released and a second set are printed and published with the caveat. I haven't yet got around, and it's one thing I want to do, is to examine every known copy of the 1649, because there are at least four or five, if not more, different versions of this thing. And it's a bibliographer's nightmare or a bibliographer's dream, depending upon the kind of bibliography. But as I say, that was a case of the Quran itself coming out in an English translation from a French translation. The French translation was generally available in England if you were able to purchase French books and read them. But at the moment, I'm afraid that's the only instance I can think of an attempt at censorship throughout the period that I know, which gets weaker and weaker as the 17th century comes to an end. There may later have been instances of things that didn't get published for censorial reasons. There are unpublished manuscripts. Now, whether they were not published because they were too Catholic, there are a number of unpublished pilgrimages from the early period. But I don't think they were not published because of censorship at the level of a state institution saying no. I think perhaps some of the Catholics who went out on pilgrimage to Jerusalem and other holy sites were simply not published because they weren't for publication. And I may be wrong there. I bet there's someone who knows a couple that were published. But I know of some unpublished ones. And I suspect they were not published because the authors didn't want to circulate them. So no, I don't know of any.
So that's been fascinating. I mean, we've taken up a lot of your time, but before we let you go, one final question: Where do you see your future research going?
Right. Well, as I said earlier, I think it'll either be a biography of this chap Thomas Glover, who was the son of a Muscovy merchant born in Istanbul, who grew up there, who became ambassador, and was one of the ambassadors that upped the ante, making Britain the Ottoman great trading partner who led a fascinating life, and or a general account of 18th century visitors during the 18th century, that will supplement work being done on Lady Mary and raise and perhaps address, if not answer, some of the questions that I failed to answer adequately here today.
Well, that sounds fascinating, and thank you for doing this for the New Books Network. It's been a fun interview.
Thank you.
Box, a lovely podcast about British Islamic interaction in the early modern world. Enough to wake the wanderlust in anyone and make them want to go down to the seas again. I hope you enjoyed the podcast. Goodbye.